really nice to be back and to see each of you. And while I was gone, I had the chance to visit two churches. And the first was in a small coastal town. And it was a beautiful 19th century wooden chapel, wooden parish with Tiffany windows, sort of a classic, you know, Episcopal church of that era. The type of beauty that we have in our denomination. And get this, the pulpit was a boat. I'm serious. It was a boat. Like all the way, you know, coming out and shape, and you could climb up the back. And I got up in it. My kids started yelling, "You're going to get in trouble." And I'm like, I don't think anybody's going to get mad at me. I hope not. But it was really cool. And I was thinking, because it sounds like we don't quite have enough money for the hot tub, that what we would do is put a mountain right here. Wouldn't that be cool? Like a little Tinker Mountain pulpit. We'll see. And the second visit was to a familiar church where we go when we're in Woods Hole. And there was a new minister there. And this church is an incredible place for our family. My son George was baptized there. And it's a beautiful church overlooking this little fishing village and the ferry boats. The preacher that day decided to do a contrast between Augustine and Pelagius. Now, if you haven't taken a seminary class in a while, you may not remember the Pelagian controversy that happened in the 5th century. But in a nutshell, they were both bishops in the early church. And Pelagius said that people can choose between good and evil, and that Adam's sin did not corrupt all of humanity. That did not corrupt all of us. And that God's role in the earth is more of the divine co-pilot, or a booster pack, if you will, to help us be a little bit better. It's there to sort of walk alongside us as a partner. Augustine said no way to that, Pelagius. We're all sinners, and we've all been twinged by the sin of Adam, aka original sin. And we've all fallen short, and that the only way to be restored, to be justified in the eyes of God, is through God's grace and God's grace alone. It's through God's grace that we're made right and good, and we don't participate in this gift of grace. So after laying out these two intense theological sides that I just gave sort of Cliff Notes versions to, he asked, "Which side are you on?" I almost jumped out of the pew when he said that. I think you all could guess which side I'm on. Maybe not, but I'll tell you in a second. And then he goes further to say, "I bet we're all just a little bit of both." And I was like, "Are we? Are we really? Where's the gospel, sir?" Anyway, I'm sorry. It was nice, but I've been holding this in for a couple weeks. I've been waiting to preach on it because the gospel hammer never came. It was never the gospel hammer that said that you have been saved by Jesus. Full stop. Never came. I think both of these stories are just examples that I myself am guilty of too, where we water down or we miss the mark on the gospel, where we forget that simple statement that I think Stephen Covey, the Harvard Business School guy, said, to keep the main thing the main thing. The main thing is Jesus' death and resurrection for you and me. The gospel, that we're saved by Christ and Him alone. And what happens is we end up focusing on history, or we try not to take strong sides on a controversy, or maybe we focus too much on boat pulpits. After all, the literature, this beautiful church, kept talking about the boat pulpit, which is really cool. But it pales in comparison to our salvation. Pales in comparison to our salvation. I love the quote that Becca Stevenson, who's a Episcopal minister in Nashville, told the House of Bishops in the Episcopal Church a few years ago. And it said that a church without the gospel is just a museum. church without the gospel is just a museum. Museums are great, but they're not the gospel. Today's gospel is reading is one of those places that we can sort of get hung up, and no pun intended, we can sort of water it down a little bit. Right? It's this famous passage of the walking on water. And sometimes we just immediately go to the sort of title track, right? The walking on water, and we become obsessed about it. Did it really happen? How do we know that it really happened? I read one commentary this week that talked about the salinity of the Sea of Galilee, except the Sea of Galilee is a freshwater lake. I was like, what are you talking about? Anyway, I'm not trying to be critical of other people. I make loads of mistakes. But the fact is they were focusing too much on trying to historicalize what had happened, to try to get into the nitty-gritty of did he walk or did he not? Was it just a sandbar that he happened to walk across the lake? I mean, that's interesting and all, but is it really? Like, maybe it was a sandbar. Or maybe I read one interpretation that said it was just what they really meant was that it was crazy rough water. So when they say he was walking across the water, they were like he was wading in like a rip current. I'm not sure if the Greek bears any of this out, so Parker's going to come up right now and explain it. He needs one more, because he needs one more surprise. But all of these different angles, right, they end up just taking your eyes off what actually is going on. What's actually going on? Job said years prior, he prophesies, who alone spreadeth out the heavens and walketh upon the waves of the sea? Meaning, Jesus walking on the water because he did and he can, because he is, after all, the creator. It's just another establishment of our relationship between us as creatures and God as the creator. But that's not the total gospel, because this story is about our desire, about our want to be accepted by the Creator. It's about the relationship, in other words, between Peter, between you and me, and Jesus. It's not about whether he performed the miracle. Sidebar, he did. But it's about our relationship with him. The desire that we all have to hear and know that we are worthy of the Creator, that we are accepted by him. And this is borne out in the dialogue that we hear. Coming from Eugene Peterson's interpretation, Peter, suddenly bold, said, Master, if it is really you, call me to come to you on the water. So Peter's testing Jesus. He's testing him to see, A, if he's really the creator, and B, if he'll really save Peter, if he will really call him into a relationship, if he'll really give him, impute to him his righteousness, his love, his power. Without flinching, Jesus says, come ahead. Jesus makes no if and no conditional responses. He just says, come to me. And jumping out of the boat, Peter walks on the water to Jesus. Now, probably like any of us, has anybody tried to float or hold a little child in the salt water to get them to float? Inevitably, they start doing it, and then they're like, oh my God, I'm floating. And then what happens? They say, yeah, thank you for that visual. They go like this. I can tell you Fred did it not but 2 weeks ago. He was up, you know, up like a chicken. There's a whole little thing. I'm not going to go into it. I'm going to run out of time. But it's like up like a chicken, arm like a dove. I can't remember. But all of a sudden you're floating. And then you're like, I can't really be floating. So you sink. You can see Jesus. You can see Peter right now looking at Jesus. And he's like, oh my God, I'm walking on the water. And what happens? He starts to sink. He starts to sink. And then what does he do? He says, save me. I love this response. And what does Jesus do? He doesn't admonish him. What's his first reaction? And this is a nugget in this text. And take it with you forever. His first reaction is he saves him. He doesn't say anything other than he reaches into the water and Jesus pulls Peter safely out. And then he says, come on, faint at heart. This is Peterson's translation. What's gotten into you? In other words, didn't you know that I'm God? Well, we all think about this. We think about our life. I think very similarly to Peter. I think Peter's is such a wonderful spoil, if you will, or sparring partner in the Gospels because he represents all of us in our questioning and who we are. We all test God to see if God will give us enough green lights to get somewhere on time. As an example, we all test God to see that sort of slowly settled in. we all test God to say, am I doing the right thing? Show me, right? Show me that this is the right thing you want me to do. Fill in the blank in your own life. We've all done it. We all do it. We all want that giant rubber stamp of approval that says you are okay, you're right, you're enough. What you're doing is what I want you to do. And it's familiar to all of us because many of us come to church to hear this good news of the gospel that we are okay, that we're accepted, that we're enough. And especially in this crumbling world, in our individual lives where we have strained marriages, strained relationships, stress up and down of markets, up and down of the storms, the horrendous pictures of what happened in Maui. I mean, just fill in the blank. The world is cruel and does not like to say, I love you and you are enough. The world likes to blare the highlight reel of death and destruction. And so then we're lost and adrift in the sea, in that rough water, looking for something to hold on to, looking for that person to tell us that we are enough. So these existential moments happen to all of us, Peter and you and me, and even Barbie. Has anybody seen, you knew that Barbie was coming up. I mean, has anybody seen the Barbie movie? It's good. I mean, I'm just saying, don't take it from me. Take it from Rotten Tomatoes or somewhere. But it's the Barbie movie. This is a new movie in case you have been living under a rock for the last couple weeks. The Barbie movie is a movie by Greta Gerwig, who's an incredible filmmaker. Lady Bird was one of her films. It's really, really talented. She did the remake of Little Women as an example. And the Barbie movie is a story about Barbie. And I'm not going to spoil it for you, but I'll just say that, you know, they're in dreamland with their high heels and they float around. There's like Dr. Barbie and all kinds of Barbies. And there's Kens in it too. So you get that. And then the main Barbie, played by Margot Robbie, has an existential crisis. Barbie starts thinking about death. And does my life mean anything? Wow. Barbie going right to level 5 on us. So I won't spoil any more of this, but there was an article in the New York Times Sunday Magazine about Greta Gerwig, which is just really, really incredible. She was talking about her hope and her aim for this film. And she described going to a Friday night Shabbat dinner, the Jewish tradition dinner on when she was in high school. And Greta had grown up in sort of the universal church. She'd gone to a Catholic school. And so she has a lot of religion sort of imagery swirling in her life, but she never had really felt God's love and presence until she was at the Shabbat dinner with her friend. And on Friday night, she went every Friday during one year of her high school. They had a ritual where the father would come along and bless each person at the table. She told the New York Times, I remember feeling the sense of whatever your wins and losses were for the week, whatever you did or you didn't do, when you come to this table on Friday night, Your value has nothing to do with that. I remember feeling so safe in that, feeling so like enough. I want people to feel like I did at that Shabbat dinner. I want them to get blessed. Peter didn't need to walk on water to receive Jesus's love, his enoughness. But he did test the Lord, and the Lord said, I love you. You are enough. You are mine. And when he faltered, Jesus pulled him right back up out of love. The gospel does this for each of us. Jesus' death on the cross is God's way to tell us that we are enough. Who we are. Not who you think you should be. Not who you're not. Not because of your wins or losses during this past week. Not because of the things done or undone or not done. Fill in the blank over the past week. But because of who you are in the pew right now. Amen.